Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today we're tackling a really critical topic, endocrine emergencies. We're diving into the body's hormonal crisis system, you know, the network that basically controls almost everything you do. The challenge here for you, our learner, is that these emergencies, they can be sneaky. They often show up with these really broad symptoms that look like a lot of other things. So our mission is to pull out the absolute must-know, urgent clinical stuff. Turn that complexity into something you can use right away, because honestly, the data shows immediate action is key. Okay, let's unpack this.
All right, so before we jump into the emergencies themselves, we kind of need a quick map of the control centers. The endocrine system, it's essentially the body's main regulator. It uses hormones, these chemical messengers, to keep everything stable, working hand in hand with the nervous system. Think of it like major command axes. You got the hypothalamus and pituitary up top, the main command.
Ah, okay. So the pituitary is kind of the master gland everyone talks about, telling the others what to do.
Exactly, precisely. It releases these tropic hormones that then go tell the thyroid, hey, manage metabolism, or the adrenal glands, deal with stress and fluids. But let's stick to the big players for emergencies, the thyroid. It pumps out thyroxine T4. That's your main metabolic engine driver, stimulating energy use everywhere. Without enough T4, well, everything just grinds down.
Okay, metabolism covered. And then those adrenal glands sitting on the kidneys, they sound like the first responders.
That's a great way to put it. They really are crisis managers. They've got two main parts. The outer bit, the cortex, gives us aldosterone for salt and water balance, super important, and cortisol, our main stress hormone. Then the inner part, the medulla, that handles norepinephrine and epinephrine.
The fight or flight stuff.
Yep, the classic fight or flight hormones,
yeah.
Triggered fast by the nervous system. So really, these three, T4, aldosterone, and cortisol, they're the main non-glucose players when things go really wrong systemically.
Here's where it gets really interesting. I mean, the system that probably impacts the most people daily and causes the most common emergencies we see, that's got to be the pancreas, right?
Oh, absolutely. The pancreas is fascinating. It does double-duty digestion with its exocrine function and hormones with its endocrine function. That endocrine part, these little clusters called the islets of Langerhans, their whole job is managing blood sugar. You've got alpha cells kicking out glucagon to raise glucose.
And beta cells making insulin to lower it.
Exactly. It's this constant tightrope walk, trying to keep blood glucose just right.
And when that tightrope snaps, that's when we get into diabetes mellitus, or DM. Now, for you listening, you probably know the basics, so let's cut past the textbook definitions. The core issue with DM is that the body just can't handle carbohydrates properly. Either not enough insulin is made, like in type 1, or the body cells just ignore the insulin that is there, that's type 2 resistance.
And that breakdown in metabolism, especially if it's not managed well, gives us those classic clues we look for in an acute situation. We call them the polys.
Ah, yes, the polys.
Polyphagia, that's being excessively hungry. Polyuria, urinating way too much. And polydipsia, just intense, unquenchable thirst. If you see those three together, you should set off major alarm bells for a serious metabolic problem.
And the scale of this is huge. We know type 2 diabetes, which is so often linked to obesity and, you know, not enough physical activity, affects millions. Then there's type 1, usually starting younger, where the body literally makes no insulin, so daily insulin is just required.
And we can't ignore the stages before full-blown diabetes either. Prediabetes, where sugars are high but not quite diabetic levels yet, and gestational diabetes during pregnancy. The gestational type often goes away after delivery, but both significantly raise the risk of developing type 2 later on. But the real reason we're focusing here is the acute danger. Long-term, yeah, high sugar is destructive, but acutely.
Right. The long-term damage is terrifying. We're talking kidney failure because the tiny filters get scarred, heart disease. And not just regular heart attacks, but sometimes silent ones because the nerves and vessels are damaged. It's the number one cause of blindness in adults too, cataracts, retinal detachment, and that nerve damage, the neuropathy, loss of feeling. It's a cascade.
Exactly, a cascade. And that brings us squarely to the acute crises. Any endocrine emergency, honestly, but especially these glucose swings, they can compromise everything. Airway, breathing, circulation, fluid balance, mental status. You have to think about the two extremes of glucose completely differently.
Okay, let's tackle the fast one first. Hypoglycemia, the low blood sugar crash.
Yeah, this is the rapid one. You're generally looking to intervene if blood glucose drops below 60 mg/dL, maybe even a bit higher depending on the patient, but it's technically defined around 45 mg/dL or less. What's causing it? Usually it's an imbalance, too much insulin given, or maybe they skipped a meal, didn't eat enough. The real danger, especially in type 1 diabetics, is they've lost that first safety net. Their body can't just automatically cut back insulin production or release glucagon when sugar drops.
And the way it presents is so striking, isn't it? Because the brain needs glucose, like, right now. So when it's low, you get these sudden, dramatic neurological signs.
Oh, yeah. It's classic. Rapid onset. Skin gets cool, clammy, maybe sweaty. That's the adrenaline kicking in. They might be trembling, feel starving. But then the brain stuff hits. Confusion, really bizarre or even combative behavior, slurred speech. It can look like a stroke or intoxication. Seizures or coma in severe cases.
So management has to be instant.
Absolutely. If the patient's awake, alert enough, and can actually swallow safely, simple sugar works fast. Oral glucose tabs, juice, even regular sugar. But the second their level of consciousness drops, giving them something by mouth is risky. They could aspirate.
Right. So what then?
That's when you need other routes. IVD50, dextrose 50% is great if you can get IV access quickly. But sometimes in the field, that's tough, right? So IM, or intranasal glucagon, is a crucial backup. It tells the liver to release stored glucose.
Okay, so that's the low side, covered fast, neurosymptoms, need sugar now. What about the other end? Hyperglycemia and DKA, diabetic ketoacidosis. That sounds slower, more insidious.
It is, much slower. Hyperglycemia just means high blood sugar, maybe over 120 mmHg, but DKA, that's a whole different level. It happens when there's a severe lack of insulin, which is why it's mostly seen in type 1 diabetes. Without insulin, sugar can't get into the cells, so the cells are starving, even though there's tons of sugar in the blood.
So the body panics and burns fat instead.
Exactly. It desperately needs energy, so it starts breaking down fat like crazy. The problem is that process creates byproducts called ketones. And ketones are acids. They build up in the blood, and the blood pH starts dropping. That's the acidosis part, life-threatening.
And the signs are totally different from hypoglycemia, right? No cool and clammy skin here.
Nope. Complete opposite, usually. DKA patients are often warm, very dry, severely dehydrated, because all that excess sugar pulls water out into the urine. And they're breathing. It's distinct. Deep, rapid breaths. We call it Kussmaul respirations.
Why the deep, rapid breathing?
It's the body's attempt to compensate for the acidosis. By breathing fast and deep, they're trying to blow off carbon dioxide, which acts like an acid in the blood, trying desperately to raise the pH back up.
And the smell.
Ah, yes. The fruity breath. That's the ketones being exhaled. It's often described as smelling like nail polish remover or juicy fruit gum. Plus, they usually feel awful nausea, vomiting, bad abdominal pain. Now, there's another hyperglycemic state we need to mention, mainly in type 2 diabetics, HHNS.
HHNS. Hyperosmolar hyperglycemic non-ketotic syndrome.
Yeah.
Okay, break that down. Non-ketotic is the key part there.
Exactly. This usually happens in type 2 folks because they still have some insulin floating around. Enough to prevent that massive fat breakdown and ketone production so they don't get the severe acidosis like in DKA.
But the sugar levels, they can get even higher, right?
Oh, incredibly high. Sometimes over 600, even 1,000 mmHg. This extreme sugar level makes the blood super concentrated. That's the hyperosmolar part. It pulls massive amounts of water out of the cells and tissues, leading to profound dehydration.
So what are the hallmarks of HHNS then, if not acidosis or ketones?
Severe dehydration is number one. And because of the extreme hyperosmolarity and dehydration affecting the brain, you see major neurological changes. Lethargy, confusion, delirium, sometimes seizures or coma. But you won't typically find the Kussmaul breathing or the fruity breath. Management, airway first, always, especially with altered mental status. And then fluids, usually starting with normal saline to get their volume back up.
Okay, that glucose divide is critical to understand. Let's shift gears a bit. What about crises from the other major players we mentioned earlier? The adrenals and the thyroid, they can cause some dramatic systemic issues too.
Absolutely. The adrenal glands can cause trouble at both extremes. First, you have adrenal insufficiency, often called Addison disease. This means the adrenals aren't making enough cortisol and aldosterone. Remember, cortisol for stress, aldosterone for salt and water.
Okay, so if they fail, what does that look like acutely? Is it shock?
It's profound shock, yes.
Yeah.
That's the Addisonian crisis. Without aldosterone, the body just dumps sodium and water into the urine. So blood volume plummets, blood pressure tanks, and it often won't respond well to just fluids alone. Also, because sodium is lost, potassium levels rise dangerously high in the blood. Treatment has to be aggressive. Lots of fluids, yes. But crucially, immediate IV hydrocortisone to replace that missing stress hormone.
Wow. Okay, and the flip side. Too much adrenal hormone.
That's Cushing syndrome, caused by excess cortisol. This usually develops more slowly, but the chronic signs are really important clues if you see them. The extra cortisol messes with fat distribution.
Ah, the buffalo hump and moon face.
Exactly those. It also cranks up blood sugar, weakens bones, breaks down muscle protein, and causes skin changes like thinning and easy bruising. Someone with Cushing's has a body already under stress, making them more vulnerable if an acute illness hits.
Makes sense. Okay, last major area, the thyroid. Again, two extremes, right? Too slow and too fast.
Precisely. Hypothyroidism is the slowdown. Metabolism decreases. Chronically, people feel cold, tired, gain weight, get dry skin. Sometimes they develop this swelling called myxedema due to material building up under the skin. The real emergency here is myxedema coma.
Coma. That sounds bad.
It's terrifyingly bad. The patient becomes profoundly hypothermic, like really low body temperature. Their mental status deteriorates so badly they often need mechanical ventilation. It's like the body is just shutting down. Everything stops.
Okay, so that's the extreme slow. What about extreme fast? Hyperthyroidism.
Right, metabolic overdrive, often caused by Graves' disease, which is an autoimmune issue. The body attacks the thyroid, making it overactive and often enlarged. That's called a goiter. They produce way too much T4.
So people feel wired, lose weight, heart races.
Exactly. But the true life-threatening emergency is thyroid storm or thyrotoxicosis. It's rarer, thank goodness, but incredibly dangerous, often triggered by some major stressor like surgery or infection in someone who already has hyperthyroidism.
And what happens in a thyroid storm?
It's like hyperthyroidism on steroids. You get all the usual signs, but cranked up to 11, plus a high fever, severe vomiting, and dangerously fast heart rates, tachycardia, that can push up towards 200 beats per minute. It completely overwhelms the cardiovascular system.
Wow. Okay, so clearly, with all these different possibilities affecting basically every system, assessment has to be sharp.
It has to be thorough and systematic, absolutely. You're looking for clues everywhere. Check the scene. Are there insulin pens, pill bottles, clues about medication use or misuse? Then look at the patient for those chronic signs we talked about. The Cushing signs, buffalo hump, moon face, or maybe bulging eyes. That's exophthalmos. You see that sometimes with Graves' disease.
And basics first, always.
Always. If someone has altered mental status, check that blood glucose early. It rules in or out hypoglycemia immediately. And get a good history if you can. Asking about known diabetes, thyroid problems, or adrenal issues is key. Also, specifically ask about heart problems or palpitations, especially if you suspect hyperthyroidism. Remember that risk of extreme tachycardia in a storm.
And clinically, what's the bottom line for transport?
The bottom line is that most patients who are truly unstable from these conditions, think myxedema coma, severe DKA or HHNS, Addisonian crisis, thyroid storm, they need definitive care quickly. Stabilize the ABCs as best you can. Get vascular access if possible. Treat hypoglycemia immediately. Start fluids for dehydration or shock. But they need rapid transport, ideally to a center equipped to handle these complex metabolic and electrolyte problems.
And keep reassessing, right?
Constantly.
Yeah.
ABCs, vital signs, level of consciousness, they can change fast. Monitor the cardiac rhythm closely, especially in DKA, where potassium shifts can cause dangerous arrhythmias. Look for those peak T waves for widening QRS complexes. Be ready for anything.
That really pulls it together. We've gone from the basic regulators through the whole spectrum of diabetes crises like DKA and HHNS and hit those really dramatic systemic shocks from the adrenals and thyroid. It connects the dots from tiny glands to huge patient impacts. So what does this all mean?
Well, we spent a lot of time on the complications stemming from metabolic failure, especially type 2 diabetes, which we know is heavily influenced by things like physical inactivity and obesity. We saw how it leads to blindness, kidney failure, heart attacks, devastating stuff. So it really makes you think, doesn't it? If the body's whole crisis management system is so profoundly affected by these metabolic issues, maybe the bigger question is, how much of this emergency burden could we actually prevent? Could shifting more focus and resources towards promoting metabolic health through lifestyle support and public health initiatives ultimately lessen the frequency of these crises down the road?
That's a powerful question to end on, linking prevention back to the acute care we've just discussed. Thank you for that insight. And thank you, our listener, for joining us for this deep dive. We hope this knowledge helps you the next time you face one of these complex endocrine emergencies. Until next time.